This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello, listeners. This is Ken Fajeras bringing you Time Magazine for this week. This week's issue is March 28th, 2026, volume 207, numbers 9 and 10. We'll begin our reading of Time this week with some articles from The Brief. Leaving Their Home by Rebecca Schneid. A new law in Kansas is forcing trans people to reconsider their futures there. Anthony Alvarez loves Kansas. He moved there when he was 11, and now every single person he cares about and loves is in the Sunflower State, he tells Time. But lately, Alvarez says he and his friends are thinking of leaving. Alvarez, a 22-year-old who will graduate from the University of Kansas this spring, came out as trans 6 years ago and says the average Kansas never bothered him about his gender. On campus, he walks into the men's restroom without hesitation, just another student moving through his day. That calculus is changing, he says. Kansas Republicans, in late February, overrode the veto of Democratic Governor Laura Kelly to pass one of the most restrictive laws in the country for transgender residents, imposing new limits on bathroom access and identification. Quote, I want to give my skills to Kansas. I want to live in the place I've called home for so long, but I can't stay in a place that's going to be outwardly hostile to me, Alvarez says. Kansas had last year already joined a wave of states legislating against gender-affirming care for minors. Prohibition supported by President Donald Trump. The new law, Senate Bill 244, focuses on restricting identification and the use of multiple occupancy private spaces, reviving the debate over bathroom bills that roiled states like North Carolina in 2016. The law goes further than many comparable bills by invalidating licenses and birth certificates that transgender people have updated to reflect their gender identities and names, and by allowing private citizens to file a civil action of up to $1,000 against a person of different sex if they are aggrieved by an invasion of privacy in some spaces. The new law's bathroom provisions create a bounty hunter regime, says LGBTQ rights group Lambda Legal, by effectively allowing people to sue transgender people who use the bathroom not aligned with their biological sex. The bill also allows people to be criminally charged with a Class B misdemeanor for repeated violations. Republican lawmakers say the law is aimed at protecting women and girls. Quote, while the governor fearmongers and muddles the water with her misleading veto message, our position remains steady. This isn't about scoring political points, but doing what's right for women and girls across our communities, State House Speaker Daniel Hawkins said in a statement after the override. The law took effect February 26. Kelly called the legislation poorly drafted, and experts worry that the measure's broad language and sweeping challenges will have unwanted consequences for anyone who uses public restrooms. Opponents of the bill say it pushed through with little public input after its bathroom bill provisions were added in late January. Quote, the goal is to single out and exclude, if not give a total license to discriminate against transgender people in the state, says Logan Casey, director of policy research at the Movement Advancement Project, a think tank. He says the law's restroom provision is not just invasive and dangerous, but one of the widest sweeping currently in the nation. While laws in Florida, Tennessee, and Texas also bar changes to gender markers for new driver's license, Kansas' reversal of existing documents is unusual. Kansas officials expect to cancel about 1,700 driver's license and issue new birth certificates for up to 1,800 people, according to Kansas Department of Revenue. Alvarez says he has gone through four IDs since 2023 as he navigated different restrictions to get new gender marker, change his name, and renew his ID after turning 21. Now he expects to be notified by mail that his ID is invalid, meaning a fifth round of paperwork. Quote, it's basically outing yourself to like every single person around you. Representative data about trans Americans is historically sparse. But a 2024 survey of 192 respondents in Kansas, run by the Trevor Project, found that 47% of LGBTQ plus 13 to 24-year-olds reported they or their family had considered leaving because of the state policies. That figure rose to 56% for trans and binary youth, non-binary youth. And Tara McKay, director of the LGBTQ plus policy lab at Vanderbilt University, points to the U.S. Transgender Survey, billed as the largest survey of transgender people in the country, which in 2020 showed that nearly a quarter of respondents reported being verbally harassed, denied benefits and services, or asked to leave establishments when they provided an ID that didn't match their presentation. Revoking IDs already issued to folks who've socially transitioned, legally transitioned, possibly medically transitioned, creates a whole set of problems, McKay says. This is a policy choice that predictably increases harm. Isaac Johnson, a transgender man who worked for years as a social worker in Kansas, credits the escalating attacks on transgender people there as his reason for moving 2 months ago to New York. Quote, I feel guilty on one hand for leaving Kansas and leaving all my friends behind, he says, but also everyone is fleeing right now. Our next article in the brief is entitled Punch Drunk Love. It's a picture of an orangutan with a stuffed animal. Punch, a seven-month-old Japanese macaw, reaches out to a stuffed orangutan at the Ikawa City Zoo in Japan on February 19th. Punch won hearts around the world with his love for the toy, a gift from zookeepers that he seemed to find comfort in after being rejected by his mother and his peers. And since going viral, he's even seen playing with other monkeys. Next, we have the bulletin. Pakistan and Afghanistan fight over insurgency. Pakistan declared open war with Taliban-led Afghanistan after two governments escalated attacks on each other in late February. Quote, our cup of patience is overflowing. Now it is open war between us and you, Pakistan's defense minister, Khawaja Asif, wrote in a social media post on February 27th. The declaration follows attacks between the countries that shattered a fragile ceasefire in place since October, when the two neighbors, which share a 1,700-mile mountainous border, traded airstrikes and were locked in intense border clashes and deadly ground fighting. Taliban forces are equipped with arms left behind by the U.S. when it withdrew in 2021. The two South Asian nations have complex history. During the 20 years of the U.S. was fighting the Taliban, Pakistan was obliged to become a base against its Islamic movement it had helped foster, and was frequently accused of allowing Taliban fighters to shelter just inside its borders. After the Taliban returned to power as the U.S. withdrew, Pakistan made the same complaint that the new government was hosting militants dubbed the Pakistani Taliban, blamed for a spate of recent suicide bombings. Between militant attacks and combat-related deaths, including several days of battle with India, Pakistan's neighbor on the other side, 2025, was Pakistan's deadliest year in more than a decade. Pakistan bombed Afghanistan's two biggest cities, Kabul, and Kandahar, as well as the border province of Pachia. After days of clashes, Islamabad says it targeted camps allegedly belonging to the military groups accused of carrying out terrorist attacks in Pakistan. Afghanistan responded with attacks on Pakistani border troops. Casualty claims have greatly varied. Pakistan claims more than 130 Taliban were killed and 200 wounded. Afghanistan reported no casualties at all. Kabul said earlier Pakistani attacks hit civilian homes and a religious school and killed at least 8 people. Afghanistan's former Prime Minister, Hamid Karzai, said the country would respond to aggression with courage. We continue with the brief from March 28, Time magazine, with the brief news. Good question. What does the Supreme Court ruling on tariffs mean for me? Miranda Gerritsen is the author. Since the Supreme Court struck down Donald Trump's emergency tariffs, questions have mounted around what the ruling means for consumers and businesses that had already paid the price of the trade policy. On February 20th, the court ruled 6-3 that Trump could not use the 1977 International Emergency Economic Powers Act, IEEPA, to impose import duties by declaring a national emergency. That effectively rolled back the sweeping Liberation Day tariffs that Trump imposed last April, as well as levies on China, Mexico, and Canada that he tied to the flow of fentanyl in the U.S. The ruling does not reverse all tariffs. Any tariff imposed under Section 232 of the 1962 Trade Expansion Act, including on steel and aluminum, remained in place. Those are based on Commerce Department investigations into whether certain imports threaten U.S. national security. Meanwhile, Trump, whose administration has argued that tariffs have generated important revenue for the U.S. and given it leverage to secure more favorable trade terms and investment pledges from other countries, invoked Section 122 of the 1974 Trade Act to impose a 10% tariff on all countries over and above our normal tariffs already being charged, which he later raised to the maximum, 15%, valid only up to 150 days. These tariffs could still face legal challenges. The administration also is planning to launch an accelerated investigations under Section 232 and Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer said. The ruling has also threatened to upend trade agreements that the U.S. struck with countries seeking to lower Trump's emergency tariff rates, resulting in potentially more price fluctuations for American consumers. The EU paused ratifying its trade deal with the U.S. as the European Commission seeks clarification about whether the bilateral agreement will be honored. A slew of countries that were either subjected to a baseline 10% tariff or who had negotiated their tariff rates down could end up with higher tariffs. Some countries like Japan and South Korea also pledged massive investments to the U.S. in order to secure trade deals, which now appear less favorable. Global trade alerts suggest that the U.K., Japan, South Korea, and some countries that struck deals with the U.S. will now pay more than they did before the ruling and new tariffs. Countries like Singapore in Australia that were paying 10% baseline tariffs before will also be subject to a higher 15% tariffs. By contrast, China, Brazil, and India benefit most as the 15% tariff replaces much higher IEEPA tariffs. Democrats began calling for federal government to issue refunds for the roughly $130 billion import duties that Trump administration collected. Senate Democrats announced the legislation that would require full refunds with interest of the money collected from emergency tariffs, amounting to around $175 billion. If enacted into law, those refunds would be issued to businesses that paid import duties, though some companies passed on all or part of the cost to consumers by hiking prices. Some Democrats have called for direct refunds to consumers. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, a potential Democratic presidential primary candidate in 2028, shared on social media a letter he sent Trump invoicing him for $8.7 billion, or $1,700 for every family in Illinois. California Governor Gavin Newsom, who has also teed up a potential presidential run in 2028, said, quote, Donald Trump has been illegally taxing your groceries, furniture, and cars for over a year. Time for a refund. But the president signaled that his administration has no intention of issuing refunds anytime soon, telling reporters that the issue could be in court for up to 5 years when he was asked about the refunds. Justice Brett Kavanaugh, one of three Supreme Court justices to side with Trump, who nominated him to the court in 2018, noted in his dissent that refunding tariffs would create a mess. The president has not given up on his signature policy, with the impact on consumers remaining to be seen. We continue with the brief with an article on health. Five phrases that will instantly get your doctor's attention. Angela Haupt is the author. Doctors just don't examine bodies, they also decode language. And some words and phrases make them lean in, ask more questions, and rethink what's going on, what might be going on. A clear, detailed conversation with a patient gets you 80% there on a diagnosis, says Dr. Robert Bierbaum, chief medical officer at WellNow Urgent Care, which has locations in five states. Quote, that's how important words are. They're the most important thing we do in adult medicine. There's no need to use medical jargon you picked up while Googling your symptoms, he adds. If a patient informs him they think they have pneumococcal pneumonia, for example, that could set the diagnosis process back. He has to start over and ask them why they think that. The most helpful language is honest and specific and focuses on changes over time and day-to-day impact, Bierbaum adds. It's the most important opt for words that signal heightened risk, capture trajectory, or shine light on functional impact rather than just discomfort. Quote, the goal isn't to just say the right word, he says. It's to clearly communicate what's different, how long it's been happening, and why it concerns you. That's what helps clinicians take the step, that right next step. The importance of language speaks to why everyone should have a primary care doctor, says Dr. Adam Stratcher, chief medical officer and director of primary care at the Weill Cornell Medicine. Quote, when you know a patient and their personality, their fears and their anxiety, it's easier to know when something is really wrong, he says. Quote, there are some patients who are a little more anxious and others who are a little more stoic, and that helps you parse how seriously to take something. We ask doctor which phrases always catch their attention and why. First one, this has been going on for months. When you're describing symptoms to your doctor, it's key to include how long you've had them. You might use a word like persistent, says Dr. James Tachi, president-elect of the American College of Preventive Medicine. The fact that any abnormality is persistent makes it more than trivial, he says. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad, but it means it's something that needs to be addressed. Second, I had to stop going to the gym. One of the most important things doctors want to know is how much symptoms are changing your daily life. Birnbaum is especially alert to phrases like interfering with sleep, Can't work. Can't eat. Can't walk. I had to stop doing X. When people start saying things like that, I haven't missed a day of work in 5 years and I had to call in because I can't work because the pain is too bad. You listen, he said. Next, I had a sudden change in strength. The word sudden signals that the timeline has shifted in an important way. Stratcher pays particular attention to phrases like sudden loss of vision, sudden sharpness of breath, and sudden change in strength. Quote, the sudden acute onset of anything gives us higher levels of suspicion that something urgently is wrong, he says. Next, I have a family history of skin cancer. Your family medical history might be recorded in your patient portal, but that doesn't necessarily mean your doctor remembers your dad had a heart attack at 52. Quote, it makes so much difference if you have a family history of what it is that you're being tested for because it puts you in a whole new category, Tachi says. That makes every physician appropriately stop, take pause, and say, okay, let's make sure we're on the right page for you based on your genetics. And last, I have a sharp chest pain that worsens with exercise and improves with rest. A helpful rule of thumb, precision beats vagueness. Providers respond most strongly to clear, concrete descriptions, Birnbaum says, rather than broad statements like, I've never felt worse in my life. They need specifics about triggers, timing, and symptoms to make the best decisions. Quote, very precise descriptions are so important for us to get to the bottom of something. We continue with our reading of Time Magazine for March 23rd, 2026, with some articles from The View. Freezing but Free. Daria Komiak is the author. I'm writing from Kyiv, where the temperature in my apartment barely reaches 40 degrees Fahrenheit. I sleep in thermal underwear, in an insulated tracksuit, and a winter hat. Recently, I added gloves. Russian attacks have destroyed 80% of our energy and heat infrastructure, working to keep Ukraine cold in what is apparently an attempt to turn us against one another. Instead, neighbors cook borscht for the entire building. Electricity can disappear for 3 days or more. Heat and water, too. Compared with my many, I'm lucky. I have a gas stove. I am also 37 years old and have all my limbs. I can walk up the stairs to my home without an elevator and carry heavy bottles of water. I can even find a yoga studio where I can shower and wash my hair. Unfortunately, I can't say the same for the elderly, people with disabilities, for veterans without limbs who need electricity to charge their prosthetics, or those who have lost their homes and simply have nowhere to go. Freezing but free. That's how I would describe my mood in Kyiv. We are tired, but we are not broken. And our perseverance can be measured in days. It has been almost 1,500 of them, 4 years and counting, since Russia invaded. I marked 1, January 13, 2026, on my calendar, the day Ukraine had officially been resisting longer than the Soviet Union fought Nazi Germany during World War II. The largest and bloodiest conflict of the 20th century. A common meme shared among soldiers, I've been fighting longer than my grandfather did. My foreign friends often tell me Ukrainians have a particular sense of humor. In Kyiv, the new joke goes, if Russian missiles and drones didn't kill you today, watch out for the dangling icicles. When the war has gone on for 2 years, I wrote an essay marking the anniversary. A lot has changed in the 2 years since. Arina Bush public activist, a combat medic, and my friend was killed May 29, 2024, on the front line near Kharkiv, just days before her 26th birthday. Around then, I was in New York preparing a benefit reading of the documentary theater piece I created, Diary of War, which Irina contributed to. American veterans were performing Diary of War to raise funds for Irina's medical battalion, Hospitallers. It was unbearable. Organizing an event in honor of my friend in New York while her friends were burying her in Kyiv. Irina changed how we say goodbye to those killed in action. In her will, she asked that mourners at her funeral sing the Ukrainian songs. That we not bring flowers, but donate to the Hospitallers. Instead of Soviet-style monuments, Irina asked for a living remembrance. Every day at 9 o'clock a.m., people in Kyiv and other Russian or Ukrainian cities stopped to honor those killed by the Russia. Yuri Tushbis, Irina's younger brother, recently raised and donated more than $3,000 to continue a university scholarship in her name. And I created the playlist for Irina's funeral, a collection of Ukrainian songs that were a soundtrack to her young life. A funeral playlist for my friend. Every person in Ukraine has their own diary of war. Every object does too. From my playlist to the box of Russian chocolates I bought for a friend. After I purchased them from a store in Kyiv, the chocolates gained a new meaning and a value when Russia destroyed the factory. It can feel impossible to feel, to measure it at all. Remembrance, grief, survival, the fight for identity, burying friends, searching for love, living in complete uncertainty, with very short planning horizon. Over the past 4 years, Ukrainians have learned not just to endure shocks, but to grow from them. We have all had to become masters of kinship, the Japanese art of repairing broken pottery in our own lives. We have learned how to glue everything back together by mourning, to replace windows blown out by drones, to find alternative ways to heat our homes, to invent new ways to keep fighting. War is a total loss of control over your own life. So I hold on to what I can still influence, telling the truth. Faced with propaganda and indifference, I try to share with the world what cannot be understood without living through it. I hope that someone is listening. The full-scale war has required all Ukrainians to make sacrifices that we had not imagined. But the Russians were wrong. The cold cannot break us. We turn to each other for warmth. We look to each other for light in the dark. We are still here, even if you no longer see us on the front pages of the newspaper. But what we cannot endure is isolation. When the world forgets us, we feel profoundly alone. In the vastness of primal cold and endless darkness. No winter can compare to that. Kolmiak is a Ukrainian activist and DJ. Next, we have the Risk Report by Ian Bremer. President Claudia Sheinbaum scored a major win last month when Mexican Special Forces killed Ruben Mimicio El Mencho Segura, leader of the country's most powerful criminal organization. This was no ordinary drug gang. Its network involved not just fentanyl tracking to the U.S., but also illegal mining, extortion, and human trafficking. And unlike most cartels, which have a hierarchical command structure, this organization operated through alliances with local gangs and small criminal groups, allowing it to expand operations across much of Mexico. But Asegura's death has also raised the stakes in Sheinbaum's battle, both contain her country's drug violence and ease pressure for action against cartels from the Trump administration. The capture or killing of cartel leaders often triggers a surge in deadly violence as factions struggle over control of organizations and retaliate against authorities. The 2024 capture of Ismael El Mayo Zambada provoked a major and sustained escalation of violence several weeks after the arrest. Since Oseguera's killing, deadly attacks have spread across cartel strongholds in half a dozen states. Sheinbaum's first priority is to prevent localized violence from spreading to places like Guadalajara, an industrial investment hub that lost the World Cup matches later this year, that will host the World Cup matches later this year, and to protect businesses, highways, and other key infrastructure. It's worth noting that Sheinbaum has adopted a much more systematic security strategy than that of her predecessor and political ally, Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador. The result of both her security-focused mindset and her recognition that violent crime remains the top concern of voters, but also a product of pressure from Washington for more direct coordination between security forces on both sides of the border, as the U.S. has provided critical intelligence and help containing the flow of guns to Mexico. Sheinbaum has worked hard to persuade Trump, and she shares his concerns about border security, partly in hopes of avoiding further U.S. action on trade or any risk that U.S. security forces might move against cartels within Mexico, compromising its sovereignty. Sheinbaum has sent a number of captured cartel members to the U.S., and Trump has publicly celebrated a major drop in fentanyl seizures since he became president. A success each can credit to higher cooperation between the two governments. But the killing of El Mencho confirmed for U.S. officials that the Mexican government could take direct, forceful action against the cartels, raising expectation in Washington that more strikes might follow. Trump's aggressive and unilateral moves against Venezuela and Cuba have heightened concerns in Mexico City that failing to keep up the intensity of the battle against cartels might persuade Trump to directly target criminal groups with cross-border strikes. Once again, Sheinbaum hopes to stay one step ahead by expanding security cooperation with the U.S. that might go beyond intelligence sharing. Yet, there is still a concern within her administration that U.S. pressure for action will expand, perhaps extending beyond the cartels themselves to political and military figures in Mexico with allied ties to organized crime. To head that off, Sheinbaum might take action against a few lower-level or former officials, but it's unlikely she would move against the high-ranking figures within her Moreno party or anyone close to Lopez Obrador. Sheinbaum also has no appetite for an all-out war with the cartels. If there is a bloody escalation, she might not be able to contain it, and the U.S. might be brought more directly into the fight. But for the moment, there's no dominant crime lords in Mexico. New ones would emerge in coming months and years, though over the past 16 years, Mexican and U.S. authorities have proved effective at capturing or killing top cartel leaders. Her administration will focus for now on containing violence as it erupts, with an overarching goal of degrading the strength of the most dangerous and effective cartels. That's a battle she has much better chance of winning. We continue with The View for Time Magazine, March 23, 2026, with the D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott. James Tallarico, the secularist seminarian armed with a biblical rejoinder for what he sees as politics sins, won the Texas hard-fought U.S. Senate Democratic primary on March 3rd, setting up a November push, once seen as a Hail Mary for his party. It was opening night of the primary season in the U.S., and his six-point win over combative progressive representative Jasmine Crockett, it appeared that an argument grounded in electability this fall prevailed, or at least found enough open ears. Quote, "This is a people-powered movement to take on this broken, corrupt political system," Tallarico said in his election night speech. "This is proof that there is something happening in Texas. Tonight, the people of our state gave this country a little bit of hope. And a little bit of hope is a dangerous thing." On the Republican side, things were heading toward another two bitter months of bruising campaign between incumbent John Cornyn and challenger Ken Paxton, the hard right and scandal-soaked state's attorney general. Neither candidate topped 50% because Representative Wesley Hunt made it a three-way contest. The runoff is scheduled for May 26th and gives Democrats a head start in what is shaping up to be a tough and costly battle that could decide which party runs the Senate for the final 2 years of President Trump's term. Electability was the core argument on that side, too. Quote, "If he's nominated, there's a high risk that Paxton could lose the Senate seat, taking five congressional seats down with him," Cornyn said on election night. "Just like the primary, we have a plan to win the runoff, and we are in the process of executing it. Judgment Day is coming for Ken Paxton." The 1.5 million plus votes cast among Democrats was more than double the number seen in 2022. Among Republicans, 1.3 million voted, up about 30% from 2022, according to the Vote Hub. The results may offer a preview of party posture in other primaries and head-to-head matchups to come. On its own, though, it suggests that Democrats' messy search for their path forward may be a battle at every step, and that Republicans may struggle to figure out how to win definitively without Trump as a vote animator. Moving on, we have Health Matters by Veronique Greenwood. Think back to the first thing you can remember, and you'll find you are likely several years old. Between us and our earlier experiences lies a mysterious barrier. Research suggests that in mice, those lost memories still exist. At the lab of Paul Franklin, of the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, researchers tagged brain cells activated as young mice learned to fear a chamber. Later, when the grown mice had forgotten their fear, researchers reactivated those cells and the mice remembered. The lab of Thomas Ryan, a neurologist at Trinity College, Dublin, has revealed that male mice whose mother's immune systems were activated during pregnancy do not forget early experiences, suggesting the immune system may be involved. What about humans? It's tricky, but Nick Turk-Brown at Yale and his colleagues have managed to scan a growing number of little kids and discovered that those as young as a year old do appear to be forming memories. This suggests humans, too, maybe making memories that just can't be reached later. It's a mystery why our brains forget our early lives. Do not early memories pose a threat somehow or to our survival? Or does the value of those memories lie in something that does not require their conscious retrieval? Perhaps they allow us to build a mental database of the way things work, Turk Brown speculates. The specifics, the things we hang on to in many of our memories, might not be what's valuable about them, and they might still be with us in ways we don't recognize. Moving on, we have questions and answers for our view. What's next for the Epstein file? By Nick Popley. Representative Ho Khanna helped force one of the most sweeping disclosures of investigative records in modern American history when Congress passed his bipartisan Epstein Files Transparency Act last year, compelling the Justice Department to release millions of documents tied to the convicted sex offender, Jeffrey Epstein. The release was triggered a wave of fallout with prominent figures across politics, business, and international institutions resigning or facing investigations, developments Connor described as the beginning of a long-awaited moral reckoning for what he calls an Epstein class of powerful people who believe themselves beyond accountability. Even though more than 3 million pages have been made public, major questions remain. Lawmakers and journalists have identified millions of additional documents still withheld or heavily redacted, including missing FBI interview summaries connected to allegations involving President Donald Trump. Trump has long said he had no knowledge of the Epstein crimes. Quote, "Why are they hiding these documents?" asked Connor, a Democrat who represents Silicon Valley area. Time spoke with Connor about why he believes the most consequential evidence remains hidden and what Congress and the courts could do next to force additional disclosures. First question, are you surprised that the files have had an impact across so many countries and industries? I had to ask someone on my team and GOP Representative Thomas Massie's team to compile a list of rich and powerful people in the United States and around the world that are being held accountable. There are dozens, and there are dozens more who need to be held accountable, and in some cases, investigated and prosecuted. I've always said, if these files are released, it will be a moral reckoning for the nation, and half of the worst stuff still hasn't been released. This is the first time in modern American history that global elite are being held accountable. Second question, do you expect more people will be implicated? Yes, I believe more people will be implicated in terms of having known about Jeffrey Epstein's pedophilia and turning a blind eye and still having engaged in business relationships with him. I believe some others will be exposed as having raped these young girls and trafficked these young girls. The problem is, though, we need documents that have not been released. The most central right now are three documents the FBI and the DOJ have covered up with a woman's allegations against Donald Trump that he sexually assaulted her when she was a minor. I have no idea on the merits, but I do believe that the problem is a cover-up. On March 5th, after Connor spoke to Time, the DOJ released the document saying their omission had been an accident. Next question. How much of the documents have we not seen? Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche has said there are about 3 million or so documents that haven't been released. And of the documents that have been released, there are too many redactions on them, and even the members of Congress are seeing documents that already had been blanked out. What responses have you gotten from the DOJ as to why these documents aren't available? They just hide behind privilege, and they claim that they are protecting survivors, but they protected the predators. They're not complying with the law. What else can Congress do to force the DOJ to release files? We can take action in the Southern District of New York to require the release. Survivors can sue to require the release under the Epstein Transparency Act. When Democrats are back in the majority, we can subpoena people at the Justice Department and FBI whistleblowers. And we need to bring in front of our committee those people who are in the files, who have been emailing about going to the island or the ranch, and ask them, under oath, what they knew. Does Congress need a second phase of legislation? Would you change anything in the bill? We could pass a second law to be even more explicit, but they may just violate the second law. Maybe there's additional punitive teeth we can put on it. Really, we need the judicial system to enforce it. What has been revealed in the files about Epstein's relationship with President Trump? They had an extensive friendship, and they spent a fair amount of time together. And that there is also, of course, allegations against President Trump by at least one woman. What we need is transparency. I don't judge the merits of any of this, but what we need is President Trump to come before the Congress and testify under oath like President Clinton. And we have one more article from The View, an essay for Time Magazine, November 23rd, 2026. Environment. A river ran through it. America's Thirsty West. Pete McBride is the author. He is a photographer and filmmaker and author of Witness to Water. I've spent most of my life chasing snow and water around the West. I knew and I grew up in cattle ranch in central Colorado. I also learned early that food does not come from the supermarket and water does not originate at the tap. Melting snow feeds our creeks and tributaries and eventually connects to the Colorado River, often described as the most loved and litigated body of water in the West. The icy, crystal clear snowmelt flows 1,450 miles through 7 states and 11 national parks, supporting on the way some 40 million Americans and 4 million acres of farmland. The delta, where it ends in Baja and Sorona, Mexico, was once the largest desert estuary in North America, boasting so many migratory birds that the sky was often blocked by blankets of wings. Today, it's a cracked earth wasteland. More a river cemetery than an oasis. I've been documenting this flow, slow motion crash. 15 years ago, I made a source to sea journey down the Colorado River for National Geographic. The point was to photograph the river's natural beauty, but also the many uses diminishing its flow. The river's plumbing network fills sprinklers and faucets from Denver to Las Vegas to San Diego and every other major Southwest city, town, farm field, and feedlot in between. Along the way, I learned for the first time that thanks to an outdated Colorado Compact, a centuries-old management agreement that expires this year, we allocated more water than the river actually supplies. The Colorado does not reach the sea anymore. It did for 6 million years, but ran dry sometime in the late 1990s. Why? Simply put, there are too many straws in the drink. On top of that, in the past 1.5 decades, drought and changing climate have cut about 20% of that flow. Tree ring science that confirms the river's lower average annual flows also shows the American Southwest is facing the driest period in 1,200 years. So the system is veering towards catastrophe. America's two largest reservoirs, Lake Powell and Lake Mead, bookend the Grand Canyon. Depleted by 80%, they are approaching dead pool when water levels drop below the levels of the outlets of the dams. For years, the phrase was used for futuristic alarmist forecast. Now, the Bureau of Reclamation says that under the worst-case hydrologic models, Lake Powell could see it next year. The compact among the parties that share the waters of the Colorado expires at the end of this year. Everyone agrees that changes need to be made, but disputes over where and how have created gridlock between the Upper Basin mountain states, Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and New Mexico, and the Lower Basin, Nevada, Arizona, and California. The tension is so visceral that the same that the state water leaders have refused to all sit at one table. Band-aid has been laid on top of Band-aid. Temporary solutions invariably fail. Native communities, which hold paper rights to 25% of the river's water, have remained overlooked and waterless. While habitats dry up, big agriculture, the largest straw in the river, continues to divert millions of acre feet to grow 10 to 15 cuttings of alfalfa crops a year for export to Saudi Arabia and China. Last year, I journeyed downstream to Lake Powell, where water levels at 28% were close to record low. I was documenting the newly visible arches, alcoves, and alleyways of Glen Canyon, which for grandeur can rival or surpass parts of the Grand Canyon. Sandstone wonders like the cathedral in the desert that had been underwater for my entire lifetime are now returning. Stained with sediment bathtub rings from weathered times, they remind us of our hubris. At the end of my trip, I spoke with a boat attendant at Bullfrog Marina, who was bemoaning the challenges facing the recreation industry. Less water, lower visitor counts, fewer boat rentals. But as I left, she pointed east and said, hopefully, we're just waiting for the snowfall to arrive. Last winter's snowpack started out well below average, then rallied in April, spiking to 97% of average based on 30-year data. But that late winter arrival didn't all reach the river. Instead, higher than normal spring temperatures created thirsty soil that soaked up half of the flow. So that hopeful runoff never came to Lake Powell or beyond to Lake Mead, both of which shrank further. By May, the runoff was so anemic that the creeks my family uses to irrigate a grass hay meadow nearly ran dry. On the cool morning of May 31st, typically high water runoff time, the water commissioner called me to say we had to turn off our ditch. Someone downstream with older water rights did not have enough water to fill their own. This was a first both for me and for the 88-year-old water commissioner who had held the job for decades. Neither of us had ever seen the creek run so low, nor heard of a call of a historic ditch in our region. When my brother and I shut the headgate, we relocated some brook trout from an eddy to the ditch back to the creek. There wasn't water for both. As I approached the final leg of my source-to-sea journey on the Colorado, my raft ran aground. I was just over the border with Mexico, even as I absorbed the shock that I had to walk the last 90 miles. It did not cross my mind that the shortfall would become evident on our ranch in the Colorado headwaters, 8,000 feet above sea level. But here we are. As I began writing this in mid-January, Colorado snowpack was just over 50% of annual average. As my neighbor, a former Olympic ski racer who knows something about snow, said to me, we have to accept that winter is just not happening. Like it or not, she's right. And as a result, we are bathing in basin-wide creek crisis. The civilization we built around our outdated water management model is proving that when we ask too much of a limited resource, it disappears. It is time for those in charge of managing this resource that produced over 12% of U.S. GDP to start thinking bigger, beyond their states and regions and water districts. It is time to face their differences, head to the river's shores, and literally climb into a raft to take a river trip together. The Colorado River managers should get in a boat in the headwaters somewhere, Shoshone Rapid in Colorado, or below the Flaming Gorge Dam in Utah, and keep floating downstream until they figure something out. Not just how to stretch less water, but how to fund infrastructure that sustains it. They took the time to listen and look at the actual river, if they did that, and worked together, pulling paddles and oars, they might find some answers downstream. I bet they would not only reconnect with the river they manage, but also find more solutions than by avoiding each other in sterile conference rooms. 5.5 decades ago, two Colorado River nemesis, Floyd Dominey in the Bureau of Reclamation, pro-dam, and David Brower of the Sierra Club, anti-dam, famously did just that. They took a river trip together. And while they did not come out as friends, they did share drinks on the river's banks at night, crash through rapids together, and return with a respect for each other and a renewed love for the river itself. Who knows if that trip was key to fewer dams on the river today, but those fierce adversaries shared more river time than our leaders do today. I have witnessed firsthand how different user groups can collaborate to keep this river running and even briefly in water its parched delta. Rafters, ranchers, anglers, hydrochlorists, energy workers, government officials, and others have coordinated to keep water in the river. I still think state water managers can do as well. And we'll end with an article from Milestones. Switched, BC to TST, a constant clock. Things will be sunnier in British Columbia going forward. That's because the Canadian province decided that after it sets its clocks ahead for daylight savings time, DST, on March 8th, it's not going to go back to standard time in the fall. Polling shows the move is popular, but it comes with risks. On daylight savings time, clock time is less aligned with the sun than it is on standard time, and that can mess with our bodies, circadian rhythms, and which it can turn lead to all manners of healthy woes. One 2025 paper estimated that DST would lower the U.S.'s prevalence of stroke by 300,000 cases. A Spanish study found that 30% increase in fatal car accidents from 1990 to 2014 on the day the clock spring forward. A 2020 study found mechanical errors like giving the wrong medicine to a patient rise by as much as 8.8% in the week following the switch. But even as the perils of DST come more evident, the U.S. is, if anything, moving in the wrong direction, with Congress annually considering a so-called Sunshine Protection Act, which would give B.C., considering a so-called Sunshine Protection Act that would follow B.C. in making DST permanent. But at least North America remains an outlier. Only about a third of the countries around the world observe DST. That ends our reading of Time Magazine for this week, the first part of our double issue for November 23rd, 2026. This is Ken Pagera signing off. Hope you have a great week. We will see you next week.